Hi guys, Quentin here from Modo. We're here with Charlotte Johnson from Kraken Flex, who we've been wanting to get on for a while. And today we're going to talk about technology in the energy storage world and how it's really changing how assets are operated. So Charlotte, thank you very much for coming on and speaking to us. Before we get started, I guess it'll be good to have for the guys at home watching or wherever they're watching this. Who is Charlotte Johnson and how do we end up here?
Well, thanks firstly for inviting me, but I'm Charlotte Johnson, a senior analyst at Kraken Flex. I've been with the company for nearly 4 years now, or just under 4 years, and there's two main areas that I focus on. One is the commercial side, so basically market modelling and market insights, and the other is strategy, so looking at the business strategy for Kraken Flex in alignment with the wider Octopus Energy Group.
Great, and so on your background before this, how did you end up in the world of energy? Did you always plan for a life in energy?
I think
that's slightly tongue-in-cheek. I don't think anyone.
So at university, I studied geography, physical geography, and then I did a master's in climate modelling, really looking at the melt rate of the Greenland ice sheet. And I think from that, obviously, carbon emissions is a massive thing and a huge driver. And I think I looked at the energy industry. They're responsible for a huge proportion of carbon emissions. So it felt like kind of the next step to do something practical in the space.
Awesome. Okay. And so Kraken Flex. Okay, let's get this out of the way. So Kraken Flex and Octopus Group. Who's Kraken Flex and how do you fit in with Octopus and what do you do?
Yeah, so Kraken Flex was originally Upside Energy.
Oh, and Upside, sorry. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
So originally Upside for probably the past 5-6 years, I think, since 2014-2015. We were acquired late last year by Octopus Energy, or the Octopus Energy Group. And within the Octopus Energy Group, you've got multiple companies. So there's Kraken Tech and Kraken Flex that are kind of related together and they sit in one side. And then you've got Octopus Energy Services, Octopus Electric Vehicles, Octopus Renewables, and then there's a number of other areas of the business too.
Okay, and so your bit, Kraken Flex, so you're based in Manchester, right? How many people are there in the company? What's the team? Is it software developers or is it commercial people? How's it split? And then who's the customer?
Yeah, so we are based in Manchester, the Northern Quarter, although we do have an office in London as well. The split is mainly, or the largest proportion of the company is software developers. So we've got a huge number of tech teams. And then we've got a small commercial side.
Okay. And Kraken Flex. So it's Kraken Flex. The Kraken Flex is the company, right?
Yes.
And then what's the product called and who's the customer?
Yeah, so the product has, it's a modular platform. So we've got four separate modules and they're basically control and dispatch. And that's where we connect to assets and dispatch them. You've got optimization, where we basically pull in market price signals and optimize the assets and decide when you should dispatch them. You then have alerts and notifications, and then you've got reporting and analytics, which is all around sort of operational performance and financial performance of the assets.
Okay, so if I got this right, you guys do but the technology, the controls,
yeah,
and do you do market access as well? So getting folks into frequency. Do you do the optimization bit, like a Habitat would or an EDF, or do you do something different?
Yeah, so it would vary between customers. In terms of ancillary services, if we start there, we basically do access to ancillary services for customers that are potentially don't have a megawatt to enter the market. So we would be
too small.
Yeah, because they're too small. So we would aggregate them and we would basically bid them into the market for them. So we do that for a number of customers at the moment, usually retail customers that have got smaller portfolios. In terms of,
so just like Joe Bloggs with his electric vehicle, or is this like what?
Slightly larger than that, to be honest. I don't think there's many electric vehicles in the ancillary service market at the moment. Mm-hmm. But it's usually CNI or small businesses. So, for example, some have got 200 kilowatt batteries, 100 kilowatt batteries, that kind of range.
Okay, cool. And so, in that case, so just going to take this back a step. So, you provide the technology and some tools for folks who are doing the optimization, right? So, is that screens for trading teams or is that algorithms? Is it price forecasting?
Yeah.
How does that all fit together?
The idea is that customers upload their own price forecast or they perhaps their own sort of market forecast.
Yeah.
They also will look at if they've got a VPP or a virtual power plant with renewable generation in as well, they'll pull in their own generation forecast. Our Optimize would look at optimizer, sorry, would look at the market prices, look at the assets that are in the portfolio and decide when to basically dispatch them.
Okay.
So you can do it that way, or you can send us a dispatch schedule via an API. So there's like two different ways, and it all depends on the customer and what their capabilities are like, really.
Okay, so who are your biggest customers right now? Are you able to say who they are and what you do for them?
Yeah, so we have four key customer groups, and the first one starting with would be asset owners. So they're sort of large fund owners that have invested in grid scale battery projects or renewable projects. So you've got kind of the likes of Eel Power would be one of them. You then have off-takers. So these would be companies like EDF Energy, Habitat Energy, Shell, and they're people that would use us to connect to a large number of distributed assets. You then have retailers, so that would be the likes of sort of Bright Energy, Haven Power, and Octopus Energy, who have a growing portfolio of either domestic flexibility or C&I flexibility. And then the final group is system operators, and that would be the likes of sort of transmission system operators or distribution system operators. And that's the kind of work that we're doing with Elia Group. So they're
saying you just signed a deal, or something was just agreed and there was a photo taken. Congrats to you and the team for doing that. Big moves abroad, right?
Yeah, one of our first international deals, actually. So Elia are the transmission system operator for Belgium and also 50 Hertz in Germany. So Germany's got four or a few different transmission system operators.
Octopus, of course, acquired Upside, which became Kraken Flex. And now you have, which is incredible, you know, you've got now some more money to spend to grow the team, deliver on the vision, deliver on the technology. So my question is, what does that look like? Now you have the backing to deliver on what the vision of the company was. What does that look like in 2030? You know, where does Kraken Flex fit into that? What's the technology going to do to your customers that's going to make their world better?
Yeah, and I think if you look across the four customer segment groups, you can see that we're trying to branch out and diversify from just one customer type. And the idea of that is to really help us be at the heart of the technology that then enables the energy transition. So to do that, internationalization is a huge one for us. So Kraken Flex and Octopus have a very strong presence in the GB market. And now it's really looking at how we can enter new geographies strategically to sort of access that vision.
Okay, and then of course Europe's first, and then Octopus is in the States now, isn't it?
Yeah, they're in the States. So Texas is the state they're in. They're in Japan with Tokyo Gas, Origin in Australia, and then Europe.
Brilliant. Okay, so and the last question about Kraken Flex. So what's the business model? How do you guys make money? Do you charge per license? Do you charge per seat? Does some, you know, is there a box that you sell? What's the business model look like?
Yeah, so there's two different sides to it. There's we're a software as a service company, so we have a subscription fee, and customers basically pay £1 per kilowatt per year fee for the volume that they put on the platform. And so you'll see that varies between customers because it depends on how many modules you take and also how big your asset is or how big your portfolio is.
Okay.
On the other side, on the
so question on that, so yeah. Because of course having 100 kilowatt assets, the math is going to be wrong in my head now, but. Put a zero on where I shouldn't, but a lot of small assets is not the same as one big asset, right? Because the amount of effort to get those small assets into the market and all the metering and registration and stuff doesn't really scale like one. So I guess it can't cost the same for that as a big unit. And that's one of the big problems that our industry needs to solve, right?
Yeah. So at a smaller level, it tends to be £1 per asset fee instead.
Yeah. All right. So now about the wider industry. So you've been around for a while. You've been doing lots of writing, and we've been following Charlotte, and I'm sure a lot of the folks watching have been following the stuff you've been writing and putting on LinkedIn. And I just want to say it's absolutely terrific. So thank you on behalf of us for putting the time in and releasing that work. So in your view of the industry as a technology provider, where does Kraken Flex sit from people who build assets and own them all the way up to the end user? How does Kraken Flex sit within that, and what are the changes that Kraken Flex is making to the industry?
Yeah, so if you're looking at it from a customer point of view, it would be sitting between the asset owner and the optimizer or the off-taker. If you're looking at it from where we physically sit in the sort of integration stack, you would have the site controller, which is something that does, or someone that does all the lower level functionality on the site. So things like sort of HVAC systems, fire suppression and detection, all the kind of monitoring and controlling of switchgear. And they're usually done by in our industry, they're called SCADA systems, but you often hear the term sort of PPC, so a power plant controller, mm-hmm. an EMS, an energy management system, or a BMS, a battery management system. So they're sort of the collective terms for a SCADA technology. We interface with that technology, and we do so by putting a piece of hardware, on site, which we call a gateway. And that gateway then allows us to communicate with the asset and also back to our cloud. And that's obviously what our customers then use to dispatch the asset through the cloud. So it's that kind of bridge between the physical asset and the cloud.
Okay, and do you provide the metering as well? So the comms for registering and metering and all the stuff for being a BMU, and do you do that?
So we don't own any of the meters on site, so we don't take any kind of liability there. That's all done by the EPC that usually organises or configures the site.
Okay.
But we would obviously advise on when you're looking at going into different markets with your asset, you really need to think about what metering you need, so the accuracy and also the resolution of it. So we can advise on that, but we wouldn't go out and procure it and install it on the site.
Okay, well, let's talk about that for a second, because you guys... I don't want to put you on the spot and say how many assets do you control now, but quite a few, and they're in a lot of different services. And so you have to pre-qualify for a lot of different services, and they're using your technology to do that. So if it's okay, can you just talk a little bit about pre-qualifying for ancillary services? So for example, in the last year we've had dynamic containment. One of the interesting things about dynamic containment, which is the new frequency response service, is it's new, it's fast, and the regime for testing to get into, to pre-qualify to get into that service, it's quite a bit more complicated than it used to be for FFR, for all older services. And so the technology requirements to pass those tests are pretty stringent. So what's your journey been like at Kraken Flex? I keep on trying to call you Upside, it's very early. At Kraken Flex, what's your journey been like, and what have you learned? What can you share with folks who are listening on how they can make sure they don't fall down any traps?
Yeah, there's been some really great developments with dynamic containment, because if you think about, it's the first sort of ancillary service that Grid has brought out that actually allows you or gives you specific rules on how you manage your state of charge or state of energy, mm-hmm. which is really important for energy limited assets. So that's great. When you think of, though, the metering, it requires 1 hertz operational metering and 20 hertz performance metering.
So operational, what does that mean, operational metering?
So operational metering is the metering that goes in real time to National Grid's control room, and it's secondly, so 1 hertz. And then the performance metering is 20 hertz, which would be delivered an hour after the event to National Grid.
Okay, so National Grid, once a second, can see generally what you're doing.
Yeah.
And then if there's a big frequency event, right, low frequency, something falls off the system, wind farm trips, something like that, then they can look back through the data at 20 hertz, or 20 times a second, and see, did you do what you're supposed to do?
Yeah, so the 20 hertz is all there to basically validate your response and to prove that you did it. In the past, with DFR, the way Grid validated it was through audits or spot checks, and they would ask for it in secondly readings for a 4-hour block.
In Excel sheets.
Yeah,
send us an Excel sheet from last month. Like, really? Yeah. Is the world still run on Excel sheets? So we don't use Excel sheets anymore.
No.
No, that's good. That's great. And so passing the test, so hypothetically, because we're just talking about energy storage on this podcast, although we do tend to talk about all sorts of stuff. Hypothetically, we've got the Modo Awesome Energy Storage Limited, and we have got 20 fantastic containers on a great site that are ready to go and get into dynamic containment. And we have used Kraken Flex for our technology provider. And so we want to get these, this 20 megawatt site or whatever it is, into the market. What's the process of us pre-qualifying? What do you have to do at Kraken Flex?
Yeah, so we need to look at the metering requirements to make sure that you've got the right meters on site and mm-hmm. the site is configured in the right way.
Yep.
Then you would go speak to an independent technical expert. So there's someone that essentially, or an ITE that was set up by National Grid a few years ago to try and speed up that process from when you've done your DFR testing or your DC testing. Instead of sending it to National Grid, you can send it to an ITE who would sign off it, and then you'd be able to send it to National Grid. So it's supposed to make it much quicker.
So you do the tests. So we'll talk about the tests in a second, but you do the tests. And then you get an expert in who is some sort of engineering bod, someone from, I don't know, one of the big engineering consultancies, I'd imagine, come in, look through your data, and then they sign it off. And then National Grid says, an IT independent technical expert is happy with this, so therefore National Grid is happy with it. Is that how it works?
Yeah. With the ITE, though, there's something to sort of bear in mind, that the earlier you bring them in or the earlier you engage them often is better, because all ITEs are very different in how they work. There's not a consistent approach. Some of them will look at the test results on an Excel spreadsheet and just sign it off and be happy. Others will actually want to go on a site visit and look at how the site's configured and look at the metering and start to probe more into about how you've generated the results. So the earlier you can kind of engage them, the better you can sort of de-risk the projects.
And so if I stop if I'm wrong here, but so you do the tests, you get a load of results, which is data, in an Excel sheet or something else, right? Yeah. And then the ITE's job is to say, did that battery do what the data says it did? Yeah. And are we measuring it in the right way?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And then what about the actual tests? So, what do I need to prove to National Grid to make sure I can get into DC?
Really, that you have a stable internet connection. So when you think, in the sense of when you're looking at the operational metering, that's the secondary data that goes to National Grid, you need to be able to, not all sites will be configured in a way that they can deliver stable readings to National Grid every second.
Yeah.
So there's a bit of leniency with some dropouts, but there's a threshold on how much you can kind of have. So you need to be able to prove that you've got a stable connection.
Just a bugbear of mine, having been involved in quite a few projects over the years, for anyone who's developing projects or building projects, make sure you get your OpenReach connection pretty early in the build out. Don't get to, you don't want to come to switch it on and then think, oh, okay, where's this BT box I need to connect to? Because it can take ages for such a small thing. And so these are mostly wired connections for Kraken, is it? Or do you do 4G cards? How does it work?
So there's a bit of both. So our preference, is usually to have a direct line. In reality, it's not possible on all sites. So a 4G connection is often used as well. And what we tend to do on those sites is to add an additional 4G SIM with a different network provider so that you've got some sort of redundancy if one of them goes down.
Great. Okay. So coming back to assets for a second, what are the differences between the assets that you connect to? So a battery does not equal the same. All these battery assets are different. We should do a calendar of these batteries one day. But they're all slightly different. They all respond very differently. You've got containerized systems out there. You've got in 40-foot containers, 20-foot containers, separate inverters, integrated systems, loads of different ways that these assets can be configured. And so if I was building an asset today and I knew that I wanted to use Kraken Flex's services in the future, what should I think about when I'm specifying this asset to make sure it's going to be a good asset for you to connect to? So we need a fixed line, a broadband connection.
Or a strong 4G connection.
Or a strong 4G connection. What else do we need?
I think you've already kind of alluded to it. Thinking about the markets you want the asset to participate in. So if it's dynamic containment or if it's the balancing mechanism, can you do that 1 hertz operational metering? And so for that, you'll need the right meter. Likewise, with dynamic containment, you'll need a 20 hertz performance meter. So have you got a frequency meter that can monitor frequency at 20 hertz? Then also an active power meter that can actually report on your readings at 20 hertz. So 20 readings a second.
It's a lot of data to be constantly sending out.
A huge volume of data compared to previous sort of markets. And then the final thing is then looking at what else is on the site. So do you need any sub-metering? So a lot of battery sites tend to put, or later down the line want to put electric vehicle charging or other assets behind the meter. So thinking about, do you have the right sub-metering and how's the site configured so that you can still deliver your DC response whilst also having other assets on the site that don't invalidate that response?
Kraken Flex connects to all sorts of different types of assets, right? So you've got big, sexy, big batteries that we love. I hear that the smaller ones are also very interesting. So can you talk to us a little bit about behind the meter, small assets, how they're different from the big ones, and what's different on the technology, in the technology realm?
Yeah. So in principle, when we connect to them, it's the same in the sense that they all have the same level of safety, security, and reliability built into the site. The difference, though, is that on a large site, so take a 70 megawatt battery farm or 110 megawatts of wind, you would have more redundancy built in or resiliency built in. So we would do additional frequency meters, we would do additional industrial PCs, just so that if anything goes down, you've got a backup. When it comes to domestic sites or smaller sites, so a few hundred kilowatts, you might have a cloud-to-cloud integration with a manufacturer, and that just makes it More cost effective for the customer, and also less disruptive because you don't need to.
So cloud to cloud, does that mean that Kraken Flex is talking to, say it's a, we always, I don't want to use Tesla again, let's use a different one. Say you've got a BYD battery in your house.
Yeah.
And you, so Kraken Flex would have an API to BYD's cloud server, which would control the battery. So you wouldn't be speaking directly to the battery, you'd be going through the OEM's cloud service.
Yeah, which is great for kind of cutting the cost down and making it more scalable. The only drawback that you might have is latency between the two cloud systems, which means you might not be able to do a service like dynamic containment.
Okay. And so these smaller, so you talked to the, see, there's more redundancy in bigger sites, and sometimes you won't put your own hardware on the site, I assume, so you just control it all via an API. How about the performance? Are smaller assets, do they perform worse than bigger assets because they're, I'm going to say something tongue-in-cheek here, but cheaper? Of course, there's a scaling cost, but how are they more difficult to get into ancillary services? Are they more of a headache or are they easier? Quite a loaded question.
Yeah, it is a loaded question. There's a few things. So if you're a small site, you'd need to be aggregated to get into an ancillary service market, which then means you need to be tested individually and also at a portfolio level. And every time you then add in a new asset or drop it into that portfolio, you have to retest the whole portfolio again. So making sure that you've got a time window blocked out to perform those tests with, I mean, if you think about electric vehicles, you're talking about hundreds of electric vehicles that you would need to get to a megawatt to then be able to test. So orchestrating that test is difficult. You also have the challenge that some of the inverters are not necessarily the same. They haven't been set up to do dynamic containment. Whereas if you're buying a large sort of 50 megawatt, 70 megawatt site, the containers you're buying have been made and spec'd out to be able to enter these markets. Yes. So there's different sides to it, yeah.
Makes sense. And now we're going to get to the bit that we really want to talk about. So everybody knows Charlotte Johnson from some of the stuff you've been writing recently. We are massive fans of the work that you've put out on LinkedIn and on your blogs. Not only the work itself and the analysis, which is awesome, but the titles of some of these pieces. And one of them that we particularly liked recently was an imperfect storm with in brackets about this winter. And some of the stuff that you talked about in that piece has really come to the front of everybody's attention since it's been written, right? So you talked about this winter being tough for our industry in lots of different ways. And I wonder whether you could just talk through what that research involved and what your view is of the market now. And let's just chat it through.
Yeah, so I originally wrote that, I think it was end of September, beginning of October time, when there was so much going on in the media about the crazy sort of volatile market prices that we were experiencing. And I really wanted to sort of disaggregate or separate the difference between the extreme pricing that we saw in the first few weeks of September versus the kind of consistently sustained high prices of gas and electricity due to rising commodity costs that we'd seen the whole year. And I think that was kind of mixed. I don't think the message was really delivered clearly, and particularly not in the media with all the sort of noise that there was about what was going on.
So what was the purpose of the piece?
Yeah, so the first few weeks of September, the market prices on the day-ahead market and the balancing mechanism were significantly higher than what they'd been the rest of the year. So I think the day-ahead price reached a new record of over £2,500 per megawatt hour, and the balancing mechanism bids and offers were accepted at over sort of £4,000 per megawatt hour.
Which is insane, right? Yeah. It feels normal to us now, you know, in December recording this, but I mean, to everybody in the industry, this is crazy. Right.
Yeah. And particularly when you think about like an average day ahead price, which could be anywhere between sort of £40 to £50 per megawatt hour, £4,000 per megawatt hour in the BM or £2,000, £3,000 per megawatt hour in the day ahead market is a massive difference.
Especially day ahead, right? Because day ahead is, you know, day ahead is, of course, day ahead. No flies on me there. But you there's so much longer after 24 hours ahead to... Usually 24 hours ahead, you can take so many actions to bring the cost of that electricity down. There's so many things you can do, but because markets are so tight, we were seeing just insane prices. And what does this mean for everybody?
Yeah, well, I think September was unique though in the sense that we weren't into the winter months yet, and we were still sort of coming out of summer. So you had so many plants offline, like the nuclear outages for summer maintenance, and the same with sort of thermal generators as well. So you had a huge volume of capacity that was missing off the system. And our market or our grid is so heavily reliant on gas. So when no one else is around, it's the gas generators that will have to set the price and will have to kind of step in. And I think that's why we saw the kind of extreme pricing. And it didn't help that wind was obviously unseasonably low during that 3-week period, and very low. I think it was like below 2 gigawatts, and there's about over 20 gigawatts of wind installed. So 10% of what is installed was obviously generating.
So we've got... unavailability of plant. It is the perfect storm, right? So we've got the unavailability of plant. We've got crazy high gas prices that we don't yet, even December of recording this, we can't see an end to that. Mm. And then power prices are mostly set by, well, in the BM, in many cases in the electricity market, power prices are set by the most expensive generator in many cases. And when it's not very windy, the power prices are set by gas generators anyway, but especially when it's not very windy, it's set by gas and in some cases coal, which we saw some really high prices there. Does Quackenflex control DSR? Because I've been thinking, this is perfect for DSR, and even some of these backup diesel generators that have got capacity market contracts and whatnot, surely they should be running now and making an absolute killing. I don't know whether that's actually happening in practice. But does Quackenflex do DSR too?
Yeah, so we do have a growing portfolio of DSR customers that are all sort of on the CNI side. So that kind of encompasses industrial heat pumps, sort of factory lines that you can turn down, refrigeration, HVAC systems, and then some backup generation.
I guess if you're a plant that produces stuff in the UK and that requires a lot of energy, you are basically doing DSR whether you like it or not now, because every day you're looking at your electricity bill and you're going, holy smokes, what can we turn off to save electricity? Which is basically DSR without an aggregator. Anyway, we digress. So the imperfect storm, this winter, craziness across the board. What does this mean for flexible assets and what's the opportunity out there?
It's a huge opportunity for providers that have got dispatchable technologies or flexible assets, like you said, because if you have a battery, you can obviously discharge into those kind of peak prices, whether it's day ahead or you can opt to enter into the BM. And the same with sort of gas generation as well. A lot of gas generators were holding back capacity on the day ahead market in the hope that they would be successful in the balancing mechanism.
Yeah, I mean, peakers right now, after so many years... so many peakers got built. They were developed and got built in sort of 2017, 18, 19, 20. And then everyone said, oh, we don't want peakers anymore. We only want batteries, which is, of course, we're battery enthusiasts, so that's great. But now if you own peakers, despite, you know, peaker valuations this year went really low, and nobody wanted to touch peakers because they were dirty gas. And then, of course, peakers are now running, are making an absolute killing. So just very, very interesting. We do need some sort of peaking generation out there, and there is a big opportunity for it. And then come back to the imperfect storm. I'm just wandering around this conversation, just knocking on doors and just going crazy. So imperfect storm, how did you finish? Because you did, if I remember correctly, there was scenario analysis. Was that your own forecast, or was that the Quackenflex forecast, or, you know, how did the scenario analysis work and what was the outcome?
Yeah, so I think it was a combination of some of the historic things we saw in the market. So we looked at how much generators were making. I think for September, it was sort of double what they'd made in previous months. And likewise for batteries, what a battery could have made or what their opportunity would have been during those sort of weeks. But really, it was looking forward to looking at National Grid's winter outlook, which looked at the derated margins, and trying to see what's the probability or what's the chance that we're going to see those extreme prices that we saw in September again in the winter months. And so I don't know if you saw National Grid's winter outlook, but they basically said that the derated margin was going to be between 3 to 4 gigawatts. And the derated margin is just basically used to illustrate any excess capacity above the underlying demand.
So at peak demand, they're saying, when everybody, classic, when Cory's on, everyone's using their kettle. No. Peak demand on a weekday triad period, usually, there's going to be X gigawatts of demand on the system. And we at National Grid, we think we've got 3 or 4 gigawatts on top spare capacity. Is that what they're saying?
Yeah.
That's quite frightening. And so what's the normal number for derated margin?
Well, it's still higher than what we saw in September. September was below sort of 2 gigawatts. So it's not too far off what we usually see in winter. I think the lowest that we've had in winter in the past 5 years has been slightly below 3 gigawatts. Okay. But the fact that it's 3 to 4 is above the lowest. So not the highest, but not the lowest.
Okay. Still though, my basic mind, that's still, I mean, a big nuclear plant is not far off that. You know, if we had a trip, quite worrying. Of course, there's other things they can do. There's other things at disposal. We had a capacity market event, a capacity market notice this week, or last week, which was rather exciting. Do you think we're going to have a capacity market event soon? We're all very excited to finally have a capacity market event. Is it going to happen?
Probably likely that it's going to happen. It's just whether or not it actually turns into a capacity market event is another thing, because the market tends to be quite good at responding. And we saw that last year. I think there was a 6 electricity margin notices and a few kind of capacity market notices, but nothing really resulted in a capacity market event. It's quite rare that we sort of get to that point, because we've got a market that's very responsive, although sensitive, it's very responsive to events that are happening.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see how much actually, you know, in an actual capacity market event, how much capacity could actually switch on for it? I don't know. What are you working on at the moment? Is there a new piece coming out? Should we?
Yes, there is a new one.
Okay.
Yeah, so I don't know if you saw the one I did last year, sort of a year in review of 2020. I think it was called The Good, The Bad and The COVID. Okay. I'll do a repeat this year, not the same title. I need a new title.
Like Spotify Unwrapped. Okay, cool.
But yeah, looking at the highs and lows that have happened this year for 2021.
And so for anyone who's listening or watching, so you can find Charlotte, how do people follow you and your work? What should they do? Follow you on LinkedIn? Are you how do we do that?
Yeah, so I have a Medium account, which I put all my blogs on, and then also LinkedIn.
Okay, awesome. And do that, because you will learn a lot. So I just want to say, Charlotte, thanks so much for coming on. It's been awesome. And we really look forward to hopefully having you back in the Modo offices sometime soon. And everybody who's watching, listening, do follow Charlotte. Can I send you a DM and ask any questions?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And see you next time. Thanks very much.
Thank you.